supersymmetry that does come from the form from starting from a non-renormalizable interaction and then putting in some higher mass dimension term. If I just wanted to work phenomenologically, then I would not have to add anything non-renormalizable. I would just say that my potential is my supersymmetric potential plus, you know, m squared phi squared, and I'm done. And you would have, again, the sort of rough picture that, well, since this is most important at low energies, and I'm trying to solve a high-energy problem, this mass term isn't going to disturb things at high energies very much. But if you ask, where would you ever get the structure where SUSY is preserved except for these dimensionful operators, where would that ever come from? Then the standard framework in which you get that is from the spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. And the way to, and there, yeah, it's basically, you can almost just do the counting to see that, yeah, so you can just do some counting to see that it'll have to come from someplace non-renormalizable. Because the SUSY breaking is parametrized by these F terms, which have mass dimension 2. And if I want to have something that depends on an F term, and then I want to have some supersymmetric interaction with some phis, two phis, so that I can get a mass, then this has mass dimension 4. And even with just one F in this example, trying to fit it into a mass dimension 3 object, which or 2 or 3 object, this K operator or the superpotential W. So clearly I'm going to have to, this would only appear with the mass suppression.
I guess my question is that a problem?
No. So I mean, generally, by the way, I mean, yeah, so maybe it helps to elaborate a little bit and say that in all of these non-renormalizable operators, certainly could arise from integrating out some other heavy thing, right? That does not break supersymmetry, but that couples to both. So I'm not gonna engineer models of that sort off the top of my head. But that's where you generally expect non-renormalizable operators to come from, is from integrating out some heavier stuff. And the fact that the non-renormalizable operator looked supersymmetric until I inserted F, that's telling me that whatever I integrated out preserved supersymmetry.
It's probably also worth mentioning, if you couple this thing to supergravity, you very naturally generate something like this with m squared.
Yeah.
Yeah. So similar to US, I'm solving the breaking concept. So if so, can we just put the subject solve the breaking term in that model and argue there is no need to use Higgs mechanism? We have some.
But so it depends. If you want to generate, in the standard model, we don't need the Higgs generate mechanism to generate mass in principle. We need it to generate mass for the particular types of field content we have in the standard model, right? So to generate, in particular, to have a consistent theory of massive spin 1 particles, the W and the Z, you need something, some source of spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Yeah, can you engineer some sort of the ring, you know, just put it on, switch out this smooth estimate for this W, and now you need some of the ring?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking, because in that, I mean, so for example, it is possible to have supersymmetry breaking lead to the, are you asking whether you could have a supersymmetric theory without a Higgs? That consistently includes the W and the Z? I mean, the question is there a scalar mode or not? Right? I think that's the physical question. Yeah. Sure. Go for it. Oh, please.
So there's a joke which I told you that the supersymmetry we've discovered half the part of time. But it's actually not a joke, and it's exactly for this reason. That there's half of a particle supersymmetric standard model, which can only get mass if you break SU2 plus U1. And the other half, all you have to do is break supersymmetry. So the particles we have discovered are the ones for which you have to break SU2 plus U1. And therefore, you need the Higgs boson or something like it. And the particles that we haven't discovered are the ones for which you only have to break supersymmetry. And so if there's some hierarchy of those breaking scales, we can understand why the particles we see in light and the particles we haven't yet seen in heaven. Now, also, of course, it'll make us unhappy if they're too heavy. But at least it does make sense what we're seeing in experiments.
In the sense that you need to break two symmetries rather than one.
Yeah, and they're asking whether we can replace Higgs Meininger, which gives that library particles, replace that Higgs Meininger with this SUSY kind of algorithm.
No, but you always need something that breaks SU2 plus U1. So there's always got to be the usual Higgs mechanism in addition to whatever breaks.
Yeah, I also added some sort of mechanism to the problem as.
Yeah,
breaks SU2 plus U1.
Yeah.
In the solvent algorithm.
No, but
that is the solution bringing SUSY. This can also bring SUSY, but you add it in the background.
Oh, are you saying can you softly give the W boson? And that will softly violate the attack.
Okay, right.
So there is no such inherent problem in SUSY.
Right. Yeah, that's really specific to the gauge symmetry breaking. Yeah. Well, and also to fermion masses that break a gauge symmetry. But your joke's only approximately true anyhow, Michael. Other questions? All right. Well, maybe I'll actually start from why I said that Michael's joke is only approximately true. That actually pretty much takes me where I wanted to go. So we talked a lot about general structure of supersymmetric potentials, and maybe I'll just remind you. So if I have a superpotential that has some mass terms then what and trilinear terms, then that will lead to a potential of all these terms where I've taken the fermionic pieces of two of the fields, plus a sum over I of the derivatives with respect to phi I squared, where I'm just going to take my superfield phi to a scalar, all of my superfields to their scalar components. Okay, and this W has to be built out of these chiral fields, not their conjugates. And the only other requirement is that it has to be gauge invariant. And more generally, if you had global symmetries, it should be invariant under all your global symmetries as well. At least that's almost true. So if I take all my fields of the standard model, I ask what kind of superpotential I can write down. Now I have to choose a convention. I think I've been guilty of choosing two different conventions for the Higgs in these lectures. So I'm going to choose my Higgs to have, let me start by introducing a Higgs field that has, that's a doublet with hypercharge of plus 1/2. And then I also have, of course, my quarks and leptons. So because of these chiral rules, my superpotential can contain things like H, Q, U conjugate, but it cannot contain things like H dagger, Q, D conjugate that I would normally write down. This term, here are each of these letters, I'll put a Yukawa coupling out front. Each of these letters represents a superfield. But because of these rules here, you can see that this includes in its potential the Yukawa couplings for the quarks, as well as these sort of partner Yukawa couplings. And it includes a series of quartic couplings. So these are going to be proportional to lambda, these to lambda squared. Say, and these were the ones that canceled the quadratic divergence from sewing those together. But all right, I do want to give mass to all the other fields in the theory. And so what that forces me to do is to add a second chiral field, kicks down, which will have hypercharge minus 1/2. So now I can add terms, sorry, this is H up, another reason that it's a good thing I've added this field is that, remember, now my Higgs has a partner, which is a chiral fermion. So if I added a chiral fermion of hypercharge 1/2 to the standard model and nothing else, I would introduce all kinds of anomalies. In particular, I'd introduce the U1 cubed anomaly. By adding another chiral field of charge minus 1/2, I cancel the that U1 cubed anomaly. And in fact, I'm guaranteed to get an anomaly-free spectrum. So whenever we talk about supersymmetric extensions of the standard model, we have these two Higgs multiplets. What that means in terms of degree of freedom counting, if we just want to talk about the components, so usually we would say our Higgs field contains our Higgs scalar doublet field. If I now write it out as an SU2 doublet, there's going to be a charged state and a neutral state. And that neutral state is complex, so there's actually also a Goldstone mode. And this is the one that gets eaten by the Z, and these get eaten by the W. And so we're left with just one physical Higgs boson. If I now have an H up and an H down, then the bosons, gauge bosons, are still going to eat the same number of degrees of freedom. And I have a second multiplet worth of scalar fields. So there's also a heavy neutral Higgs, both, well, it could be heavy, it could be light, a priori, I don't know, both a real and imaginary part, and a charged Higgs boson. That's a physical scalar degree of freedom. Also, since I'm writing down my superpotential here, I might as well finish the job, because there's one more term that I could write down involving the Higgses. Which is this kind of mass term. Now, perhaps it's worth pointing out that I've just added precisely the kind of mass term that, you know, this is a mass term for Higgs bosons as an arbitrary parameter in my theory. The whole kind of thing that so this looks like I might have thrown out the baby with the bathwater, because I've just added a Higgs mass that is not protected by supersymmetry. However, it's still radiatively stable for this mass term to be small. So it's something that you need to explain in any model of supersymmetry breaking, where this mass scale comes from. But it's not inconsistent for it to be the same size as all your Susy breaking effects. The other thing I should say at this point is that I haven't told you any reason why you shouldn't write down operators, a couple of different operators. In particular, you'll notice that this H down has exactly the same quantum numbers as the left-handed lepton doublets. So I haven't given you any reason not to write down operators like this, or that, or any of these. And there's actually a third one that you can write down. These don't have analogs in just the standard amount, in just the standard model, because while they're gauge invariant combinations, they carry fermion number. So we would never write them in a Lagrangian. They're spinner valued quantities. But with the superfields that are scalars, I now can write them down. Now, often all of these are taken to vanish. They can be forbidden by a symmetry called R parity, which is basically asserting that there's some Z2 symmetry under which my Higgs doublets are even, and all of these are odd. And so you see that with that Z2, all of these terms are allowed. And all of these terms would be odd under the Z2 and can be forbidden. It's also possible to have other symmetries distinct from R parity that forbid a combination of those terms, but not all of them. So for example, if I imposed a lepton number symmetry, but allowed baryon number violation, the lepton number, this violates lepton number by one unit, this violates lepton number by one unit, and this violates lepton number by one unit. This doesn't involve leptons, so that would still be allowed by a lepton number symmetry. Similarly, if I had a baryon number symmetry requirement, this one would go away, and these would all be allowed. But so for simplicity and for most of this discussion, I will assume there is an R parity symmetry and then come back to it later. So there's two things that I haven't told you about that we need to get anything like the standard model. The first, of course, is the gauge interactions. I haven't written down gauge interactions supersymmetrically. And I'm not going to do it in a complete way because, well, it's a lot like the structure of the chiral multiplets, but a little more complicated. But I'll do it heuristically. And then the second thing that I haven't told you about is where to get a Higgs potential from. In particular, I have that one mass term, but there's no quartic, and there's actually flat directions left over by that mass term. So at the renormalizable level, before breaking, I want to at least make sure I have a source for the Higgs quartic. And only then would I have a reasonable starting point for breaking supersymmetry and getting a theory of nature. So for gauge interactions, you can use a lot of the same kinds of diagrammatic intuition that I showed you up there. So of course, we know that, say, our electron has an electromagnetic charge. So there's that kind of coupling. That there is a fermion associated with the photon and a boson associated with the electron. So it's not surprising that there would also be this kind of an interaction, where just like up there, I've sort of interchanged a boson and a fermion for their interrelated partners. Now, there's also a different auxiliary field associated with the photon. Well, sorry, before I do that, we also know that the scalar partner of the electron is itself charged under electromagnetism. So just ordinary gauge invariance guarantees that I should have this kind of interaction, as well as a two-photon vertex. And similarly for all the others. So this follows from sort of naive application of the supersymmetry relations, and these follow just from the gauge invariance of the whole theory. Now, there's one more piece, just like we got a quartic from auxiliary fields in the case of the matter interactions, there's also a quartic that comes from supersymmetric gauge interactions. I actually alluded to this briefly when we were talking about mass terms for dark sectors, because it plays a role there. Just like when I wrote down that dw d phi term, that was really coming from solving for this auxiliary field. Or one way to think about it, if I want to think in a manifestly supersymmetric way, is that that came from from solving for f, where f was this auxiliary field. In the case of gauge bosons, there's an auxiliary field called d, and that falls in an adjoint of the gauge group, which in general is just a sum of, is well, the gauge coupling times a sum of phi star times an appropriate representation matrix times phi for the ith particles. And there's a correction to the potential that goes like the sum over all A of D squared. Again, diagrammatically, what that corresponds to would be that something like this, say two scalar partners of the electron, can couple to that auxiliary field D. And then that might couple to some other, that also couples to other charged particles. So I can connect the lines this way. Now, it occurred to me over lunch that there's one important difference. I think Itai's analogy was a good one between these auxiliary fields and the zero component of a gauge field. But there is one important difference that will probably confuse you at some point if it hasn't yet. And that's, as Itai mentioned, that let me tell you what, say it this way. This I'm writing down, it's really a contact interaction. Whereas when we think about what the effect of A0 is, it's a Coulomb potential, it's a non-local effect. And that has to do with what Itai mentioned, that the action for these auxiliary fields has no derivatives, spatial or time, whereas the action for A0 in a gauge theory has spatial derivatives in it. So because they're spatial derivatives, when you invert the when you solve for that potential, you're going to get something that's non-locally dependent on the sources, and you get an action at a distance potential. These don't give you any kind of action at a distance. Even though I'm drawing a line in a Feynman diagram, this is really just contracting to a contact interaction. So in SUSY, unlike engaged theories, these auxiliaries are really just giving you contact terms. Now, I drew this in the case of electromagnetism between electron and muon superpartners. But of course, you'll also recognize this kind of effect can give you interactions between other charged particles. And in particular, it can give you interactions between all your weak charged particles. So this effect is actually a source of a Higgs potential. So at tree level, you get a Higgs quartic that looks like H up squared minus H down squared squared times G1 squared plus G2 squared over 8. You'll recognize this G1 squared plus G2 squared as the same combination of couplings that goes into setting the Z mass. And so this fact is why at tree level, I'm not going to do the whole solution yet, and I haven't given you all the information for it yet, but this is morally why at tree level you would expect the mass of the Higgs, of the lightest physical Higgs boson, to be less than the mass of the Z. Now, there's also loop level corrections from SUSY breaking. And those actually, and in non-minimal extensions of the MSSM, you could add additional interactions even at tree level. Okay, so there's non-minimal. New tree level sources. If these are absent, then the loop level contributions actually have to be fairly large. And so that tends to push the top superpartner masses up a little higher in terms of where you'd expect them to be. As one example of how you could get something non-minimal from new sources at tree level, you can just imagine adding a singlet to that theory with a coupling goes like H up, H down singlet. And then if you look at that derivative term of the potential, it's going to include an H up, H down magnitude squared from the piece where I take dw d singlet mod squared. And this is what happens in the NMSSM. Okay, just as an example, because this tree level prediction is not a prediction of supersymmetry per se. It's a prediction of the minimal supersymmetric standard model at tree level. So I don't want to overstate it. Then, of course, the other thing I have to do is break SUSY. Okay, so we can see that that aside from that mu term, I don't have any sources of mass here. I actually can't break electroweak symmetry without adding more. But I already talked about one type of breaking, which is to add terms of the form m phi squared for every scalar. So say, m squared phi squared. M squared h up squared. Similarly for h down squared. Also, by the way, masses for the In the same way that you generate these masses, you would also expect to generate squark masses. Now, I have three flavors of squark. And in principle, since they all have the same gauge charges, I should really think of that mass squared as being some 3x3 matrix. So in general, under flavor, that would be, let's say that I'm talking about the left-handed quarks, that would be an 8 plus 1 representation of the flavor symmetry, SU3, Q. So I can write down completely flavor invariant masses. I can also write down masses with or flavor blind mass, and I can also write down masses with a new flavor structure. And this one is constrained considerably by various flavor measurements. In particular, things like the physics of the KK bar system being as consistent as they are with the standard model. So roughly speaking, I think this requires, this requires one of two things. Either you have a nice, i.e. mostly one, flavor structure for the mass. So it's mostly universal. And it can be nice at some scale, and then it's going to run, and you're going to get additional standard model, additional flavor-dependent effects on the masses, but those flavor-dependent effects are generated by the standard model Yukawa's and generally have less of a problem for flavor. Or you just have heavy squarks. And I actually forgot to look up exactly how heavy they need to be. I think for sort of for non-CP violating flavor effects, if you wanted to just have order one sort of anarchic flavor structure, it would have to be around 50 TeV, if I'm remembering right, and more like 500 for if you also have large CP violating phases. But at lower masses are perfectly fine as long as whatever's mediating the breaking of supersymmetry, the dominant breaking of supersymmetry to your standard model, is doing so in a way that respects the flavor symmetries. And so that kind of mass term could come from, if you want to think about it as arising from some spontaneous breaking, from some x dagger x over m squared phi star phi, where that x has some supersymmetry breaking them. Now, that's the breaking in this first part of the supersymmetric Lagrangian. One could also get breaking associated with sticking VEVs into something like W. And it's sort of not surprising how that'll turn out. So something like this would give you then what's generally called a B term times phi 1, phi 2. Actually, sorry. In that case, that is an example where you don't need, where it's not, it's a mass that doesn't come from an unnormalizable interaction. And so the only example of this in the MSSM would be an additional Higgs mass term of that form. And then you can have things like this, right? And that will lead to a dimension. So this has mass dimension 2, to mass dimension 1 coefficient times product of three scalar terms. And this would give me, and examples of this are basically all of them, every one of the Yukawa couplings. So I could have an A up squark, left-handed squark. And these also can potentially introduce some new flavor structure, or they might just have the same flavor structure as the standard model. Finally, depends on where they come from. It's not generally true that they would always have the same structure of the standard model. But if they're going to be substantial, then they had better have comparable to the mouse terms. Then they had better have the same flavor structure as the standard model by some mechanism. So in many models, you might actually not generate this except through radiative corrections, for example. Yeah.
How can you get from the third term the arrangement of S dot and S squared? I mean, how can you guess the S dot is lighter than the other S squared according to the breaking of your third term? You mentioned the original having mass for S squared.
So the squarks get masses from two sources. This is one source of masses,
yeah.
Right? And this is another.
Yeah.
So if, for example, if you look at what this does to the squark mass matrix, it tends to take, let's say that you had left and right squarks of equal masses from just like with equal mass terms up here, and then you added one of these A terms for the third generation, it would tend to make one stop lighter, one stop heavier. I don't think you can guess that from anything that I've laid out here. Another factor that comes into play in determining the masses of different squarks, let's say Susie is broken at a high mass scale, then you have to account for the RG evolution of the masses as you go to lower scales, and that can have the effect of lowering the stop mass substantially. But I would not say that there's any generic expectation that the stop is much lighter than other squarks, or at least that both stops are lighter than other squarks, or that there's a substantial difference. So, sorry, did I say that earlier?
Yeah.
That it's...
Yeah, I have a general question.
Okay.
So, your system is about this one. How can you guess from MSSM that the mass of LSPs, for example, from controlling the virus, and then S of S of gravity from these terms?
I would make no such... Sorry, if I made such a statement, then I just badly misspoke.
No.
Or maybe you misunderstood. No, I mean, you cannot predict the hierarchies, certainly at this level, where I haven't talked about any RG evolution. You can't predict the hierarchy. You should be open to different hierarchies that you might see. Now you can set different limits depending on what hierarchy you have. And there are certain theoretical biases that depending on, you know, of different types, that would favor one type of structure over another. So there are some models where you have large sources of first two generation masses and smaller sources of the third generation squark masses. There are other models where you have exactly basically the same masses, and then there's just a small amount of renormalization group evolution that pushes them around a little bit. And I'm not trying to make a general statement. You can't make general statements about what spectrum you expect without picking a particular model and studying its consequences. Right now, all this is doing is sort of phenomenologically prescribing what kinds of mass terms there can, what structure the mass terms can have. And this leaves a lot of freedom, right? I haven't told you whether I have flavor blind or flavor dependent masses. That's an input. If a full theory of how supersymmetry breaking is transmitted to the standard model might give you a prediction for that. But I'm not even trying to tell that part of the story, right? And there's many versions of it that work and that give different answers.
Can we use, for example, M-super for determining the specific arrangement for the
If you assume an M-super boundary condition, then you can infer a certain spectrum. And so that's a case where you're making some assumptions that are certainly simple. I don't really think they're that theoretically justified for what the UV boundary conditions are at a very high mass scale, assuming that supersymmetry is transmitted to the standard model at very high mass scales, and then you have a lot of renormalization group evolution. And that tends to produce a particular kind of hierarchy. But if that's not the dominant mode of SUSY transmission to the standard model, then that hierarchy is the wrong answer, right? So one can certainly consider all these different scenarios, and these top-down scenarios are useful to consider. But it's often useful first just to understand what's the framework, what's allowed by the structure of the theory. And then you ask what are some different models that populate different corners of that parameter space. So yeah, certainly, I mean, this is telling you nothing about the spectrum, except for the basic question of who gets mass from supersymmetry breaking alone. Okay, and who gets, you know, who are the half that Michael would expect to discover first, and who are the half that Michael would expect to be discovered last. That's the only kind of question that you can answer with the kind of analysis that I'm doing, because I'm just not giving you enough details. I'm not telling you what the coefficients are or where they come from, right? I'm just saying, imagine that supersymmetry is broken by other fields. What's the most general structure of interactions you can have? Is that everything you want? No. Is it a useful starting point for thinking about how do I test this whole framework? Of course it is, right? So that's where I'm trying to go with it. So there's also Gugino mass terms. I haven't introduced the notation for this column to make sense. But not surprisingly, so there's actually two types. The thing that's most commonly considered is just a Majorana mass term like this. So say your Gluino is an adjoint. You can contract two Gluinos together into a gauge singlet and write down a mass term. There's also the possibility of introducing some new field, some new matter field that just happens to be an adjoint, and writing a direct mass for the Gugino. This is called supersoft. Now, I've just added a bunch of adjoints, light adjoint fields. Haven't really told you why. I'm just introducing them so that I can talk about one more kind of mass term that's possible. By introducing those adjoint fields, you spoil gauge coupling unification. So that might be one reason not to add them. But it actually, adding this kind of mass term does ameliorate some of the fine-tuning constraints on weak scale supersymmetry. So it's interesting to think about from that point of view, and that's why I mentioned it. So, well, as you were just saying, I haven't told you what the spectrum is. Within this framework, you can have lots of different kinds of spectrum. And I would love to know what the spectrum in nature is, because you can learn a lot from that about where the supersymmetry breaking came from. But we won't know what the spectrum is until we find it. So I think in thinking about the collider phenomenology of supersymmetric models, it's actually a really good exercise to just throw down some spectrum, okay? Never mind whether it's, you know, how reasonable you think it is or not. And just ask the question, if this was the spectrum, what would I see? What searches would be sensitive to it? What are the dominant particles that you're producing with that spectrum? And how does each type decay? Now, there are certain commonalities that you'll see in the spectra that people usually draw, some of which you mentioned. So for example, people usually talk about spectra where the electroweak charged particles, or at least the electroweak gauginos, are much lighter than the colored particles. And there's a top-down motivation for that. Which is that if you start with roughly equal masses at very high scales, then renormalization group evolution will tend to raise the colored particle, enhance the colored particle masses by a log, but by a large factor, basically by large rounding, and the electroweak ones much less so. So top down, there's just this expectation that if you have a long RG evolution, it would lead to splitting. From a bottom up point of view, this is also a nice feature for a spectrum to have, because if you have a neutral lightest superpartner, it can be stable. It can be a dark matter candidate. Although, as Mariangela mentioned, there's some amount of tuning involved in making that work, depending on the spectrum. And that's relatively, you know, and that simultaneously gives you clean collider signals for decays. But not much of a signal for actually producing that lightest particle itself, right? So that's one kind of bias that you'll often see. Another bias that you didn't see much of a decade ago, or even 5 years ago, but that you see a lot now, is this bias that there's a top, that the top partners, maybe the bottom partners, are much lighter than the light generation squarks. And these days, this is often called natural Susie, which I think is a fairly misleading name. What's true is that if you want to minimize fine tuning in theories of the Higgs mass consistent with observations, in theories with a low scale of supersymmetry being mediated to the standard model, then you want to have this kind of spectrum. So with low mediation scale, so this is all bottom up, what I'm about to say. With a low mediation scale, this can ameliorate fine tuning. Not because it's intrinsically good for fine tuning to have light stops, but because it's intrinsic or to have stops lighter than the squarks. But because it's good for fine tuning to have the stops as light as possible, and it's good for experimental consistency to have, you know, to have, and whereas the experimental limits on the light generation quarks are very good. So if you can decouple those two scales, make the light generation quarks as heavy as they have to be while keeping the stops light, then you get, in these low mediation scale models, you get ameliorated fine tuning. Back in the 80s, I think, this kind of hierarchy was also talked about in more top-down models. Well, there was another bottom-up motivation, which is that it can make some of the flavor constraints a bit easier to satisfy. That depends on the details of how it's actually implemented. You can see, I mean, from what I was saying, so it's true that most of the flavor constraints are on things like the kaon system. So that involves the lighter two generations. Decoupling the first two generations certainly helps with that. But just by the fact that you're introducing a difference between the third generation and the first two generations, you're also doing something that inherently makes flavor a little bit more dangerous. So the flavor constraints, maybe I should put a bit of a plus or minus on that. And there are top-down models, so-called direct mediation, models that realize this spectrum, just like there are top-down models that realize a degenerate spectrum. But I think because this natural Suzy language is so much in vogue, I do want to explain there's models that give it, there's models that give you this, there's models that give you degeneracies between, or rough degeneracies between all the quarks. It's not that Suzy is sort of intrinsically wants the superpartners, top superpartners, to be lighter than the other superpartners. It's that if you try to engineer the most natural possible model consistent with current constraints, you'll end up getting squeezed into this regime by how powerful the constraints on the other quarks are. Okay, so I actually was, I actually don't have that much more to say that I have time to say. So I'm actually going to need to leave right around 3. I want to just stop now to discuss what you guys want to talk about for the next 5 minutes. Yeah.
You haven't made any comments on other paradigms to solve the natural problem. Do you have anything to say?
In the next 5 minutes? No. No. I mean, there. Other than yes, there are many, and they all deserve to be looked at and elaborated on, both theoretically and experimentally. And I just had finite time. Yeah, so right. So okay, so maybe I'll make a slightly a more general comment related to that. So there's the MSSM, right? And the old school supersymmetry analyses pretty much looked for the phenomena that you would expect in the MSSM with a conserved R parity. Now, in that case, this is very important, I should have said it. In that case, every one of the interactions that I wrote down involved an even number of superpartners. Zero, 2, or 4. What that means is that the lightest superpartner can't decay through any of those interactions, right? Because if it can decay, it would just decay into another superpartner. But by assumption, it's the lightest one, so it can't do that. So that the lightest MSSM superpartner is stable. Now that's an assumption, right? So it can be violated in two ways. One is that we don't actually have that symmetry. So if our parity isn't a good symmetry, then obviously the argument against it, you know, the argument that it's stable goes away, and you would expect it to decay back into standard model particles. But another possibility is just that there's more stuff out there that might be very weakly coupled to us, but non-zero coupling. And it also respects, there's a larger R parity that includes both us and them, and this other stuff. And in that case, then it's very natural to expect that the lightest superpartner of the MSSM can decay into that hidden sector. So simple versions of this can include just adding a singlet. And in that case, the lightest superpartner would decay to the new singlet scalar, singlet fermion, for example. Singlet scalar is even under this R parity. It can decay back to the standard model, typically by mixing with the Higgs. Maybe you get a couple of B quarks from it. Singlet fermion is stable, and it carries its stable invisible particle. But depending on the spectrum, it might carry much less of the transverse energy than your original stable MSSM superpartner would. So there's parts of the parameter space where this assumption that the lightest superpartner is stable is violated in a way that qualitatively changes the signals at the LHC, and in particular, this very zeroth order question of how much missing energy you have. So R parity violation is one example. Singlets are another example. There's actually regions of parameter space for very canonical SUSY models, like gauge mediation, where you can get this sort of stealth type signal as well. And there's more models that you can write down. Basically, all involve adding some stuff to the supersymmetric Lagrangian. Either adding some smaller parity violating interactions or adding some interactions with another sector. And is any one particular modification a really well-motivated theory? No, any one is not. I don't think, except maybe the gauge mediation one, but most of the parameter space that's currently open for that actually isn't that stealthy. But is it motivated to think about that qualitative possibility that there might be more than just the MSSM and that it qualitatively changes what you see? That, I think, is very well motivated. Right? So it's one of these cases where the specific models and their motivation aren't so important. The qualitative lesson from them is what's important. You mean in a fundamental sense? I don't actually know any good top-down arguments for our parity myself. That might just be my ignorance, though.
It can come out of guts, like out of like one of the gut subgroups that can produce our parity is one of the resultants of the larger group that you initially had. So that's one option.
I mean, I don't view it as inevitable, but it is motivated. So one thing I didn't mention. Sorry, did I mention it? Proton decay? Okay. Yeah, if you had all of those R parity violating operators together, you could have proton decay that occurs extremely fast because it's only suppressed by the weak scale. So as a simple example, you can have in a proton, an up and down quark, go to a strange quark through the UDD type interaction. And then that strange quark go to a neutrino and a down quark, I think, through the QLD. And so then this is your proton. This is a pion, pi plus. And your proton decay lifetime. Your proton decay width is just going to scale like m proton to the fifth over the SUSY breaking mass scale to the fourth times some couplings. And so that's a very basic phenomenological problem. Now, R parity is not the only way to avoid that phenomenological problem. If you, for example, had I was mentioning that baryon number symmetry would forbid all but this last term. And so that would also keep the proton decay from being a problem. There's also some nice models of, again, I don't know how solid they are from the top down, but it's a nice phenomenological observation that if you insist on all of these couplings being some order one parameter times a product of flavor structures that you see in the standard model, so Yukawa couplings, that hierarchical structure would be strong enough to actually keep the proton stable. Even though it's not that baryons are intrinsically stable, it's just that baryons made up of up and down quarks are stable. So there are variations on the theme. R parity conservation is not necessary to save the proton from weak scale proton decay, but it's certainly one good way to do it. Right. So J is the spin, L is lepton number, and that's the quark number.
So spin is always conserved. Lepton and baryon number might not be conserved, but they certainly have to be conserved in the real world to a very high level. And then in guts, there may be specific mechanisms to break them. And so very often those specific mechanisms will preserve this one. So this is the answer.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with this particular argument, sorry. Yeah. Actually, despite spending almost all of these last two lectures on sort of Suzy formalism and stuff, I am not a Suzy model builder. by either training or inclination. So sorry. All right. Well, if that's it, I guess I should hand it over to Matthias, right? But Matthias may think that he's starting at 3:15 or something. And Itai had to step out. So let's just